In October 1917, the working class of the Russian Empire was the driving force behind the first socialist revolution in history. They overthrew a centuries-old empire in February 1917. After a nine-month interregnum during which a liberal democratic regime failed to deliver on their most pressing demands, they took power through democratic councils known as Soviets. The new Soviet power hardly had a chance to draw breath, much less to build socialism, before it was plunged into a war of terrible scope and fury. Those who had made the revolution were now drawn in their millions into the struggle to defend it, and they were the essential core around which the new Red Army was built. Before the war, many of them would have worked their 10-hour days with the heat of a blast furnace on their skin. Now they carried its Promethean fire to the Arctic Circle and the deserts of Central Asia. They fought from the streets of Moscow to the Siberian taiga and the Mongolian steppe. In the north, they were supplied by sleds, in the south, by camel caravans. It was not only a Russian affair, far from it. But we call this struggle, because nobody has come up with a better name, the Russian Civil War. This is Revolution Under Siege, a new series from the 1919 Review that tells the story of the Russian Civil War. The dramatic events of the year 1918 are the focus of Series 1, which adds up to 10 parts, plus short posts. Series 2 will deal with 1919, and the third series will explore the events of 1920 and later dates. This podcast is from a great blog called the 1919 Review. For the text version of this episode, which has the citations and latest updates and whatnot, look up 1919review.wordpress.com. So as I said, the name Russian Civil War is not perfect, because under that name we neatly file away a whole range of conflicts that encompassed 1/6 of the land surface of the earth. In this sixth of the earth, only 44% of the people living there were actually Russian in the strict sense. Here's an American propaganda video from the 1940s, from the 5-minute period during which America and the Soviet Union were friends. It commits some bad blunders along the way, but it gives a sense of the vast diversity of this huge area.
Whether they are the great Russians, the descendants of the first settlers of this vast area, and for 1,000 years its main population, or Cossacks, or famous horsemen from the open plains of the Don River Valley. The Ukraine. And beside them, the Moldavians and Bessarabians. Or if they come from the far south, between the Caspian and Black Seas, find the Armenians and the Georgians, the Ingush, the Cherkess, rugged as the high peaks of their native Caucasian mountains. Whether they are Uzbeks, Turkmen, Kyrgyz, from the Persian and Indian frontiers, or Mongols, Turko-Tartars, the Buryats, the Yakuts, from far beyond the Ural Mountains. Or the people of the ice country, hunters like the Zounds, or settlers like the Laplanders.
It was, to quote one historian, a world war condensed. Japan, Britain, France, the United States, and Germany were just some of the countries which invaded Russian lands on every point of the compass. To take an even more strange example, the struggle for Kazan in 1918 involved Czechs fighting Latvians on Tatar land. In 1920, Russian sailors skirmished with the Gurkhas of the British military on the coast of Iran. There are over 15 states in Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and the Caucasus which include this war as a chapter in their national histories. A Civil War era flag became a symbol of protests in Belarus in 2020. And when we come to deal with events in Ukraine, in Series 2, the place names will echo the news reports from the current war. And we call this the Russian Civil War, but as I say, nobody's come up with a better name yet. Rather than say that the Russian Revolution spilled over into other countries, I think it's more accurate to say that Russia was the most advanced front in a global revolutionary offensive. Italy had its Biennio Rosso, 2 red years. Spain, its Triennio Bolshevico, 3 Bolshevik years. Ireland, its Soviet movement. In Germany and Hungary, there were Soviet republics in 1919. It's impossible to draw lines on the map to mark the strict limits of this war. Historians can't even agree whether it lasted 2.5, 3, 5, or even 10 years. By the way, and I'll probably say this in every post, sorry in advance for any Slavic names I mispronounce, or even Italian and Spanish names. Anyway, in all this complexity, there's nonetheless a key and central axis of the war, the struggle between the Red Army and the White Armies. In October, having chosen the Bolshevik Party as their political instrument, after testing and finding wanting several other parties, the working class took power and began the construction of a new socialist order. The White Armies came together to destroy this new order. The Red Army was forged in the heat of the struggle to defend it. This was fundamentally a struggle between classes. Industrial workers formed a core support base of the Reds. White-collar workers, poor peasants, and artisans were drawn to their banner. On the other side, under the White Banner, were big business owners, landlords, and the church. The core of the White fighting strength, meanwhile, was made up of officers of the old army, cadets, and students, the sons of the middle and wealthy classes. In the Russian Empire in 1917, there were 3.6 million factory and mine workers, among 18.5 million wage workers of all kinds. That's a hell of a lot of people, and it was a vast and very diverse mass of people. But the Russian Empire contained between 150 million and 180 million people at the time, so the working class made up a minority, a large minority, but still a minority. The wealthy, the business owners, the aristocrats, made up another minority, obviously a much smaller one. But most of the population fell into neither category. Different elements were magnetically attracted to the red or white poles. Let's take a brief look at three of the major categories here, the peasants, the Cossacks, and the intelligentsia. Peasants, those who worked in agriculture, made up two-thirds of the population. 80% of the total population of the Russian Empire lived in the countryside. The peasants were a diverse category that included wealthy, middle, and poor farmers. Over the course of the Civil War, peasant attitudes towards the Reds embraced two extremes of enthusiasm and hostility, along with everything in between. But there was a consistent attitude of sullen hostility to the Whites, the faction of the hated landlords. The Cossacks were a privileged military caste. Several million people settled on the borders of Russia. Without them, the White Armies would simply not have been viable. Only one-fifth of those who fought among the Cossacks did so under the Red Flag. But from the point of view of the White leaders, the Cossacks could be unreliable, parochial, etc. We would now use the term PMC, or professional middle classes, and these made up another large minority in the Russian Empire. These were doctors, lawyers, etc., known in Russia as the intelligentsia. Now, you thought I mispronounced that. In English, we say intelligentsia, but it's originally a Russian term. They had always seen themselves as leaders of the revolution. But when the revolution actually happened, they were terrified of it. And they were afraid of the factory workers and the soldiers who had taken control. Having said that, you know, some of the intelligentsia were red, more tended toward the Whites early on. Some changed sides as the war went on. They were caught in the middle. There's a reason why some of the most well-known novels that come out of the Civil War focused on the intelligentsia, in the case of Dr. Zhivago, and the Cossacks, Quiet Dawn, or And Quiet Flows the Dawn, as it's also known. These were the social layers caught in the middle of the Civil War, tortured by their split loyalties. These middle layers attempt to rise up and break the bipolar struggle of white and red to form some third force. All these attempts, as it happened and as you'll see, ended in failure and usually in being subsumed into the white camp. But there's a good reason why, in spite of all the complexity, most scholars continue to regard this as a single war and not as a bunch of different little wars. It is because of this, because a single overriding question was at issue, whether the October Revolution would stand or fall. As the series will demonstrate, this was fundamentally a question of class.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship, a self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
That's what it's all about. If only people would...
Please, please, good people.
The Russian Civil War is really, really interesting because it goes against our common notions of what war is supposed to look like. Our military history buffs tend to like and expect clear front lines and two sides neatly differentiated by crisp, mass-produced uniforms. This was very different. We're used to military history where officers and politicians are making all the decisions, where human agency is a monopoly of the top brass. Barring the catastrophic defeat of such and such a corps or such and such a division, we expect it to remain the same from month to month and even from year to year. In the Russian Civil War, grand plans were not just hampered by the day-to-day friction of logistics, terrain, and morale. The war in large part consisted of this friction. This was a war in which an officer, if he wanted to send bullets to the front line, would often have to conscript a peasant woman and commandeer her family's bullock cart. It was not rare for a regiment to decimate itself overnight in a bloody mutiny and go over to the other side. The bold coloured arrows on maps were frustrated on both sides by train cars falling apart, fuel shortages, mutinies, desertion, and guerrilla warfare. We expect revolutionary war to be unconventional, but the Russian Civil War also defies what we expect to see in an unconventional war. Those who've read about the Chinese, Cuban, and Vietnamese revolutions are primed to think that revolutionary war equals guerrilla war. Mao and Che Guevara are taken as authorities on how communists are supposed to fight.
From then on, Batista began to close his Sierra Maestra barracks. And Fidel was right. It was exactly as José Martí said. Whoever takes Sierra Maestra takes Cuba.
But long before Mao and Che, it was the White Guards, the counter-revolutionaries, who retreated to remote areas, carried out raids, sent agents into the enemy rear, and perished in terrible numbers on heroic long marches. So did the Reds, of course, as the Iron Flood will attest. But the Reds won the war by moving beyond that, by building a regular and professional army, albeit one of a kind the world had never seen before, and has not seen since. By the end of 1918, it was total war, desperate and cruel. But it was fought in the wake of the First World War, against a backdrop of exhaustion and collapse. I'll give you an example of what I mean. In World War I, the Tsarist Russian army had placed 300,000 cavalry in the field. 300,000. By 1921, the Reds were awfully proud of themselves that they had a 1st Cavalry Army numbering 16,000. The Civil War was fought, therefore, with the improvised human and material leftovers of the Great War. And there was something post-apocalyptic in its whole aspect. The revolution was a rupture between medieval and modern. This fault line is visible in the striking image of the Tachanka, a piece of military technology popular with the Reds, a horse-drawn cart with a Maxim machine gun bolted onto it. Reds and whites alike tallied up their armories not just in rifles, but in swords. Armored trains with naval guns dominated the railways. In some places, metal workers forged pikes when no rifles were to hand. Men and women were out there fighting for a classless, stateless, high-tech future society, all the while wearing boots made from the bark of a birch tree. A far greater number of Russians died in combat in World War I than in the Civil War, but years of civil war compounded the famine and epidemics that had already come to the boil during the World War and had helped provoke the revolution. The harsh winters of 1918, 19, and 20 were hell in the cities, and St. Petersburg was literally half deserted. Not an exaggeration at all. Millions perished in the rural areas during the famine of 1921-2 especially. This mass mortality consumed the people with every day that the Civil War ground on. By the end, it added up to a yawning demographic gulf in the population of the Soviet Union. Terror, practiced by all the contending forces, made its contribution, and not a small contribution, to this death toll. It is almost accepted as a truism in the West that this vast loss of life was somehow the responsibility of those who made the revolution, but the narrative that follows will challenge that. To move on to another controversy, the Civil War created several necessary conditions for the rise of Stalinism, that is, for the betrayal of the revolution and the establishment of a dictatorship by a self-interested and conservative caste. In one short post, I have drawn attention to every individual mentioned in Series 1 who was later killed by the Stalin regime. But for Stalinism to arise, other vital conditions were necessary too. An account of the Civil War which works backwards from Stalinism, which is burdened with the weight of explaining it, will have huge blind spots. Supporters of the Reds were fighting for control of the land that they tilled, for their rights as women or as members of minority groups, for socialism, for democracy. They accepted the need for emergency wartime measures, which included violence, even terror, and the curtailing of democratic rights temporarily. But if they had been asked to fight for a repressive one-party state, they would not have done so. To portray them as dupes of the Bolsheviks is to do a disservice to them, and to the Bolsheviks, incidentally. The promise of a better future helped the workers and poor people to endure the horrors of war and hunger in the short term. And this was not a false promise. The conquests of World War I, for which millions died, were to be Istanbul or parts of Poland. The conquests of the Russian Civil War were the 8-hour working day, free healthcare and social insurance, vastly expanded access to education, housing costs reduced to a small sliver of the income, the redistribution of land in favour of tens of millions of people, the right to divorce, abortion and contraception, the decriminalisation of homosexuality, self-determination for nationalities, and the banning of racist violence and discrimination.
Miss Lenin, will he be the new Tsar then?
Listen, Daddy, no more Tsars, no more masters, only workers in a workers' state. How about that?
It is only possible to dismiss these gains if you first dismiss the interests of working class people, poor people, women and minorities as beneath consideration. Of course, we would be very naive to think that no historian has ever implicitly made this dismissal. The above list of the gains of the revolution, following close on a description of the horrors of the Civil War, could be misread as implying that the hunger and violence were a necessary sacrifice to achieve those ends. But as we'll see, there was nothing necessary about it. The Civil War could have ended in April 1918, or in January 1919, if the White Guards and the interventionists had been willing to take that course. On the other side, a fateful Red mistake in 1920 prolonged and deepened the war unnecessarily by several months. Suffering did not ennoble the revolution. Hunger and violence damaged the revolution, placed limits on its gains, and, along with other factors, helped to lay the foundations for Stalinism. Speaking for myself, my sympathies are with the working classes and the poor of Russia and of the nations oppressed by the Tsarist Empire, who made a revolution and fought to defend it in the most intense and challenging conditions. Just in case you haven't picked up on that. Real sympathy does not preclude criticism or a sincere attempt to understand the other side. In any case, no adult with political opinions can read about the Russian Civil War and remain uninvested and dispassionate. These events are rich and complex enough that, provided I do them justice, different people will probably take away different things. Most historians today writing about the Russian Civil War apologize for their subject and almost dismiss it. For Jonathan Smeal, its only relevance today is in relation to the national question. The class angle, the red versus white angle, is relevant only to historical reenactors. On the contrary, I see the Russian Civil War as something that is really urgently relevant for the 21st century. For one thing, and making it really, really obvious, the Russian state today is leveling cities and driving millions of people before them in the name of the same Russia one and indivisible for which the whites made civil war. Putin publicly blames Lenin and the Bolsheviks for writing Ukrainian self-determination into the Soviet constitution. But the Russian Civil War has relevance all over the world, too. 20 years ago, capitalism seemed like the only show in town. But now, with disease, climate change, economic crises, war and poverty, the bourgeois liberal utopia is receding ever further into the distance. Revolution and counter-revolution are realities of our time. Just a month or two ago, as I record this, the palace of President Rajapaksa of Sri Lanka was stormed, and protesters took a dip in a swimming pool. There are lessons in the story of the Russian Civil War. Lessons that have been largely ignored for 100 years. The Revolutionary War in the former Russian Empire was worker-based, and not primarily, or even largely, a guerrilla struggle. Unlike in Eastern Europe after 1945, it was a mass popular movement, and not largely a bureaucratic revolution from above. And unlike the Paris Commune or the Spanish Civil War, this working-class popular revolutionary war was victorious. In the last 30 years, meanwhile, the urban population has grown massively on a global scale at the expense of the rural population, which makes the study of urban working-class revolutions all the more relevant when the field is dominated by attention being paid to rural and peasant-based revolutions. English-speaking writers sympathetic to the revolution, from John Reed all the way up to China Mieville, have written about 1917, but have not really dared to tackle the Civil War in the same way. Trotsky's planned history of the war was never written. The manuscript for Victor Serge's Year Two of the Russian Revolution was lost. This is a strange situation, because when you break down the most common condemnations of the revolution that you hear from liberals and conservatives, it seems that 90% of these condemnations relate to Stalinism, and most of the remaining 10% relate not to 1917 at all, but to the Civil War. And yet the history of that war remains neglected. This is a narrative and not a polemic, but a political defense of the Red Side can easily be drawn from what I write. Issues over which Red and White fought 100 years ago, class, socialism and capitalism, democracy, gender, race, national oppression, these are issues over which we're still fighting in the 21st century, in one way or another, usually not with armored trains. We all have this baggage. Don't leave it at the door when you're taking on revolution under siege. Bring it with you and engage in dialogue with it. The next two posts will deal with the opening shots of the war, in the process exploring the origins of the Red and White armies. Until then, slán liv. Onak ma ibra abu.